I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. The final week of the 2019 Missouri session has been chaotic for lawmakers. Monday, the House approved a tax break bill for General Motors, despite an attempt by one group of legislators to block it. Today, a look at that group, the Missouri Senate Conservative Caucus. We'll find out who these senators are, what they want, and how other Republicans in the state feel about them. Plus, we'll get a rundown on issues still up for debate. Then, Kansas City blues fans would love new music from hometown singer Kelly Hunt, whose last album was 5 years ago. We'll ask Hunt about her musical influences and find out if she's back in the recording studio. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. They are called the Missouri Senate Conservative Caucus, and in the final days of the 2019 session in the state capitol, they are having an outsized impact. Their latest move involved blocking a last-minute bill that would provide major tax breaks to General Motors if it expands one of its plants in Wentzville that makes trucks and vans. That bill finally passed. The caucus has also blocked a prescription drug monitoring program and has sought to cut income taxes. Other top issues: regulatory reform, tort reform, health care reform, abortion, and gun rights. One senator from Lee's Summit calls them the Chaos Caucus. With us, Jason Rosenbaum is with St. Louis Public Radio. He joins us via Skype from Jefferson City. Jason, welcome back.
Thank you for having me, Steve.
Brian Hawsworth is with MissouriNet, and he joins us from KBIA in Columbia. Brian, good morning to you.
Good morning to you, Steve. Always a pleasure.
Jason, how important has this block of senators become in the halls of the Missouri State Capitol?
It depends on the issue. I was here in Jefferson City when they were trying to make changes to a bonding plan to bolster the state's bridges. And in that particular policy discussion, they were influential because they were able to change the plan to make it predicated on getting a federal grant. In the situation that you just alluded to, where the Senate was trying to pass incentive plan for General Motors, along with a number of Governor Parsons' workforce development priorities, I would contend that they didn't really get anything that they wanted. They ended up passing the bill as is. They didn't take anything out that Governor Parson wanted. And I just think it really just depends on the issue. Any block of senators, whether they be Democrat or Republican, can be an effective coalition because that's enough people to stall or filibuster right. things to push people into compromise. But sometimes that power only stretches you so far, as we saw yesterday.
Brian Hawsworth, I'm curious what you think of this band of lawmakers.
Well, this all started, guys, back in January after the Senate President Pro Tem Dave Schatz and after Governor Mike Parson essentially unveiled the bridge bonding plan. That's the first time I had really heard of them. Keep in mind, most of the members of the Senate Republican caucus are conservatives, but this is a band of senators who really have a diverse opinion of views on a couple of issues. But as you mentioned, they're opposed to PDMP. They are opposed to bridge bonding and GM. So that's when we really first started hearing it about the bridge bonding bill. But where they really flex the muscles was last week and this week in terms of the GM bill. They did not feel that the governor should have put the fast track provision into the GM incentive bill. They were completely opposed to that. They also have been saying, and Jason has heard this, Steve, that they feel like the governor and Rob Dixon have been using what they call a slush fund, their words, not mine, involving GM. So they have, in fact, Andrew Koenig's term on the floor, he called part of the governor's proposal about GM a disgrace. So this has certainly not been a partisan issue. And with six members, when they're up 24 to 10, six members is huge because keep in mind the Democrats, the 10 Democrats are united. So yes, they have the votes to shut down the chamber. And quite frankly, I thought that they would keep keep the filibuster going. I thought maybe at one point they'd try to go all the way to Friday. Hmm. In the end, they decided that abortion was a bigger issue to them, but they made their point for sure.
Abortion being an issue that's still outstanding in Jefferson City. Jason Rosenbaum, why did this group get together to begin with?
I think there's probably a couple reasons. If you look at the individual members, a number of them won very competitive primaries where the primary is the election. People like Senator Cindy O'Loughlin and Senator Bob Onder, Senator Bill Eigel. Mm-hmm. All three of those people kind of ran against quote-unquote more establishment candidates. I mean, two of them in particular, O'Loughlin and Eigel, had never been elected to anything before. And Onder had been away from Missouri politics since 2008 until he came back in 2014. So I think that there is kind of that string with them where there's kind of an anti-establishment vibe that kind of grew within them even before they were sworn into office. Hmm. And I think that they just had the realization that if they band together on certain things, as Brian mentioned, they can be effective at forcing compromise. There are two reasons people use the filibuster in the Missouri Senate. One is to force the bill handler to come to the table and make changes, which is what happened for the bonding package. And the other is to completely try to kill something. I don't think that's what they were trying to do with the GM/workforce development package. I think they were trying to change the bill, as they mentioned over and over again. And that was just an instance where they just weren't successful.
Mm-hmm. Brian, do we know ultimately what this group wants?
I think what they're trying to do ultimately, and this kind of ties into what Jason said, I think Jason hit it right on the head with these primaries. They are trying to push essentially the president pro tem, Dave Schatz, who they view as too moderate. They're trying to pull him to the right, and they want to see this particular governor, Mike Parson, govern more from the right rather than where he is right now, which is probably right center. I really think that is where they are at, because on a lot of other issues, they're not necessarily united themselves, but they definitely don't want PDMP. And I'm not even sure that's
going to be the prescription drug monitoring program. Yeah,
exactly. They're mm-hmm. opposed to that. The transportation funding, the group of them were opposed to the bonding, but for different reasons. Onder and Eigel specifically felt like that roads and bridges in St. Charles County would not get enough funding. O'Loughlin was more concerned about Northeast Missouri. So on that one, it was more of a local issue. And on issues like GM, I agree with Jason, they weren't trying to kill the bill, but they made it very clear up until the very end that GM did not want fast track, according to them. The governor says they did. So, again, that was a case where they were clearly contradicting the governor on that. So they now, will they try to do any more filibusters later this week? It remains to be seen. Anything we see on abortion is probably going to be a Democratic filibuster.
Yeah.
But yes, they definitely are trying to move shots towards the right.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date, and we're talking about a new faction in the Missouri State House. It's the Missouri Senate Conservative Caucus. We're talking about their outsized influence. Jason Rosenbaum, you know, State Senator Mike Searpoy, who's from our neck of the woods, a Republican from Lee Summit, has called this group the Chaos Caucus and sparred with them publicly. I can only imagine that other Republicans are frustrated with their fellow Republicans in the Senate. What do we know about that?
I don't think that's a particularly new phenomenon. I think especially since the Republican majority in the Senate has grown over a supermajority level, the Senate GOP caucus has become fairly factionalized. We saw this earlier in the decade with people like Rob Schaff and Brian Nieves and Jim Lemke kind of banding together to force compromise or to block things. Schaff himself was very much a critic of now former Governor Eric Greitens and had a couple of allies that were able to try to stymie his agenda. And the best person that I could think of is Senator Jason Crowell, former Senator Jason Crowell of Cape Girardeau, who was such a force in the Senate that sometimes he was able to change the trajectory of things that didn't seem super controversial just by himself. So I imagine people like Searpoy are frustrated because they took a lot of time to get to the Senate to try to actually like accomplish specific policy goals. But when you have such a large majority of Republicans, one of the consequences of that is you're going to have different worldviews on things.
Yeah, yeah. What does Governor Parsons say about this group, Brian? Do we have any sense if he's frustrated?
Well, there's no question, I'm sure, privately he's frustrated. I mean, you can kind of sense that he is trying to stay on message. I mean, when he talked to the media yesterday, Steve and Jason, he was making it very clear. He went out of his way to say that, I'm paraphrasing here, but these senators have every right to do what they want to do. I respect their position, but they should allow an up or down vote. So he was not not directly nor indirectly criticizing. He just kept saying we need an up or down vote. But obviously, there are a number of other priorities that the governor has, and they have been really the two biggest priorities, I would say, this year would be the bridge bonding and GM, and they've been directly opposed to the governor's plan. So I'm sure that has not gone over well on the second floor. That said, they've stood their ground, and when it comes time to the abortion bill, they'll all be on the same page. The question is, after abortion, will there be anything else that comes up? And it's hard to say at this point.
I was going to say, Jason, they've gotten rolled over both on bridge bonding and the GM plant now, right?
No, I wouldn't say they got rolled over on bridge bonding. I think that they were actually able to change that to their liking by making the bonding triggered by a federal grant. I would say, though,
and that was a significant enough change that you would say that they stood their ground on that and won something.
I would say so. But on the GM workforce development legislation, I don't really think there's any way to argue that they were successful when they passed the exact bill that Governor Parson wanted, which included a lot of his major priorities for workforce development. In fact, like when we're going to be writing like the session overviews, because of just of that, you could make a solid argument that it was a pretty successful session for Governor Parson, because that's what he said he wanted to do as a major priority, and that's what he got. Hmm. And it's interesting because we haven't been really able to write that about a governor probably since Matt Blunt in 2005.
Right. You know, I wanted to ask about the prescription drug monitoring program, Brian. Just to reiterate, Missouri remains the last state in the country without one. This program is aimed at helping pharmacists recognize those who are abusing opioids. What was their concern about that issue?
Well, it has to do with privacy, and they're concerned about privacy. They're concerned about freedom. They don't believe that the government should establish this electronic database to track the prescriptions. They make the argument just because 49 other states have it, it's something that Missouri should not do. So they're opposed to that. Now, we haven't heard a lot of that come up yet. They had enough, obviously, clout to stall it when it came up. But if it does reach the floor, and there's no guarantee it'll come back to the floor this year, we think it probably will, but we don't know for sure, they'll be opposed to that. And the other point, Steve, if I could go back to something you just mentioned to Jason about the governor's victory. I agree with everything Jason said to you just moments ago, but there's one key thing about that the governor's victory. The victory happened primarily because Dave Schatz, the president pro tem, would not accept the House message on the second GM bill. That's unprecedented. The House passed a second version, and Schatz would not accept the message, which means he would not accept the bill. So he really stood there and took the heat from the conservative caucus. But really, in the end, there was only one bill to pass because there was no second bill that came up. That was huge.
Why did he do that, Brian? Just walk with me one step further there.
I think it's because he felt like, and he made it very clear to me and to the Capitol Press Corps, and I'm sure to Jason, that when GM came to him and to the governor, according to him, and I've tried to reach out to GM spokeswoman in Wentzville, and she has not gotten back to me on this, but he said that GM made it clear that they wanted fast track, that they wanted the closing fund, that they were interested in the workforce development. Senator Under and Senator Igel have said that that is not what GM has said. Brian Spencer said that they never said that to his face. So, you know, I mean, that's I'm not saying somebody's lying. I'm just saying that basically the other side is saying the other side is lying on that. So, yes, that is where it's at. And Schatz would not take the message. And ultimately, because of that, they only had one vote to go on, and that was the first bill. And take a look at Rob Vescovo's tweet, the majority leader, who's a staunch ally of the governor and, quite frankly, an ally of Schatz. He tweeted just yesterday, and I'm being paraphrasing here, but he made it clear that he did not think that was good policy to not take a House message. I've never seen it happen before.
Because the House can't be happy with that, obviously.
No, because what happens if they decide to do it again?
Right, exactly.
On another
exactly.
issue.
Yeah. What's the big issue, Jason, in the final days, the final hours almost at this point of the 2019 session? They adjourn at 6 o'clock on Friday. Is abortion the big issue that still sits out there?
I would say that's definitely the one that's coming to mind right now. When Senator Onder ended up ending.
Let me just say, this abortion bill would make abortions illegal if a fetal heartbeat is found. Other states around the country have addressed the same issue.
Right. And it was basically said that was going to be the next order of business. And there's a pretty wide expectation that this bill is going to pass, whether it be by the Democrats in the Senate standing down or the Republicans using a parliamentary maneuver to stop a filibuster. But that's not the only major issue that hasn't been finished yet. As of now, there has not been legislation aimed at overhauling the state low-income housing tax credit program. Mm-hmm. Governor Parson has made pretty clear at the beginning of the session that he was not going to use his power as governor to restart that program unless the legislature acted.
That's a big issue here in the Kansas City area, for what it's worth. Yeah,
it is. And, you know, I've already started talking with advocates for LIHTC, and they're already trying to make the argument that since a version of the bill passed overwhelmingly in the House and the Senate, then that would give the pretext for the governor to restart the program. But, you know, he is on record pretty strongly saying that he wanted something done on that issue. And, you know, that pronouncement's going to be played back at him after this session if something isn't passed. I wouldn't be surprised if there was something passed on that issue, because I don't think the differences between the House and the Senate are as great as in years past. But time is a valuable commodity here in the Missouri legislature.
Brian, do you think do you share Jason's optimism that the abortion bill will probably pass as well?
It's hard to say, guys. It really is, because I don't know how long Senator Nasheed will and the Democrats will be able to basically stand up and filibuster. I would say a long time. The biggest question is, would Dave Schatz PQ it? Would he call the previous question? I know it's a priority for the Republicans.
Which automatically ends a filibuster. It's one of those rarely used powers that really disrupts good relations inside the upper chamber of the Missouri General Assembly.
Exactly. And the question is, for the Republicans, how important is it? Is it that much of a priority they would do it, Steve? Because if they call the previous question, the Democrats will shut the chamber down. It'll be completely shut down and nothing else will get done. But I would say the other two big issues would be sports wagering. That is really going to face an uphill climb because of the timing right now. And it's not really been a priority for Speaker Har nor Pro Tem Schatz, but that still could come up. PDMP is a big issue, and one that wouldn't be a legislative issue, be a report, is the issue, and Jason's followed this very closely, as have you, Steve, is the issue of the Department of Revenue. The Oversight Committee, which is in the House, chaired by Robert Ross, has been holding a number, and they have mainly in the earlier part of the session, hearings about the Department of Revenue. They are working on a final report about the Department of Revenue. I talked to Robert Ross earlier in the week. It's not done yet. Maybe we'll see it done by Friday, maybe not, but that's something that we at least could see some House floor discussion on, and maybe a report at some point. But at this point, timing is going to be the biggest thing. But abortion, I'd say, is still up in the air.
As we begin to wrap up here, what's the hang up with sports wagering? That's one issue that a lot of Missourians can relate to and can connect with. And it would provide some new revenue for the state, which a lot of folks think is desperately needed. Why not get one passed? Other states are moving ahead on it.
Part of the problem, Steve, is there are so many different bills. Cody Smith, the House Budget Committee chairman, has his own version. Robert Ross has a similar version. He's a Republican from UConn. Senator Hoskins, who's a member of this conservative caucus, it has his own version as well in the Senate. All of those are similar but different. They are obviously in the House, particularly, especially in the Bible Belt, there are several members, wouldn't say a majority, but a number of them that have philosophical concerns with wagering. They don't think that's something that's appropriate, and they don't like that, some of them. And also the governor has not made it a priority, which makes a difference. When he had the APD at the Capitol back in January, mm-hmm. he said it's probably inevitable. However, he made it clear it's something he's not going to push for.
Okay, we're going to leave our conversation there. I want to thank our two expert reporters who joined us today, Jason Rosenbaum with St. Louis Public Radio and Brian Hosworth with MissouriNet. Gentlemen, always great to have you here. Thanks for the good insights.
Thank you.
Thanks, Steve. Thanks, Jason.
Time for a break. When we come back, we'll visit with Kelly Hunt, the great blues musician from Kansas City. We'll ask her, when's her next album going to hit? I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And welcome back. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday on the show, New York Times Magazine writer Emily Bazelon discussed how the power of prosecutors has contributed to mass incarceration in the U.S. Hear that and other previous episodes at kcur.org/uptodate. Tomorrow, we'll look at the state of the public education system in Kansas City, Missouri. We'll learn about a recent system analysis from KCPS and find out what it says about how parents and students navigate schools here. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, Kelly Hunt says people are hungry for new music. So maybe a fair question is, why has it been so long since we've heard some new tunes from the Kansas City blues singer? After all, making music is something that Kelly Hunt has done a lot in a career that now spans 6 studio albums and more than 1,500 live performances, including another one coming up Saturday night at the Folly. Her latest album, 2014's The Beautiful Bones, earned her some of the biggest accolades of her career, but that was a long 5 years ago. So it's a mystery, and we're about to get to the bottom of it as Kelly Hunt joins us here in the studio. Before we chat, here's Kelly singing I've Got a Good Feeling from The Beautiful Bones. Well, Kelly Hunt, so good to have you back here again. Welcome.
Thanks, Steve. It's great to see you
again.
Well,
that sounds good. That sounds really good. Why should we talk and ruin it? Just play the whole album and we should just shut up for a while. That's
all
good
right.
Music, Kelly.
Thank you, Steve.
So help me here and your fans. It's been a while since a new album's been out. When's it coming? Because people are waiting.
Well, I can tell you this. It'll be out. We're shooting to have it out third quarter of this year. And it is in process. I've already done 7 tracks, pre-production work, and oh, man, the ball is rolling.
How long does it take to put together an album these days? Pre-production? You're talking a lingo that I don't know much about. What is all that stuff?
Well, I think it's just preparation for, meaning that I lay down some tracks and have a listen. We're sifting through material. And I think the timing between albums, like you said, you know, it's feels like it's been a while for folks. And I think, you know, when you look back or when I look back at my career, it's about the same interval that I've done between every album, between 4 and 6 years. And
so there should be no panic out there. Then.
There should be no panic whatsoever because, you know, I'm in process. But, you know, I will say, too, back when the first self-titled CD came out, we started our own record company at a time when that wasn't really the norm.
Right.
And the first couple records came out on that and the third one was on a label, Coda Terra, out in New York. Eventually, there were issues with the label itself, and we had to buy back the masters and re-release. But it's a process that takes, you know, the amount of time that it takes. And
going out on your own, was that the right thing to do in terms of your own label?
It sure felt like it, and it really feels like it, you know, over the years.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a lot to be said for both approaches, independent, being on a label. I've had both experiences, and there are people that are successful at both.
Mm-hmm.
So
why is going out on your own preferable? What would be the argument there?
Well, I think some of it has to do with, well, the creative license, you know, and understanding that it takes the time it takes to be mindful about the material you choose and how you want to be represented out in the world.
And you can take the time you need to get it done the way you want it done.
Yeah, creative control.
It's your call at that point.
It really is. I mean, I have a team. My husband and manager, Al Berman, he's been my business partner for over 25 years. And we have, you know, publicists and distributors. We have a good team that works with us. It's not like what people might think or might have thought of back in the day.
Right.
It's really something. I mean, even Bonnie Raitt has her own label.
Mm-hmm.
And creative control is a real thing.
So when you're on a label, you get pressure to produce something maybe faster than you want to produce it?
It depends on the label. And I think a lot of those contracts require you to have a recording out every 12 to 18 months.
Right.
And sometimes that's great. I'm not saying that, you know, that can't be a good thing.
Deadlines make people produce what they got to do.
Sure, sure.
Yeah.
And, you know, and I'm lucky enough to be touring. I tour, you know, year round, although it obviously ramps up when there's a release of a new recording. My touring does ramp up and
yeah.
for the cycle of that record. And Beautiful Bones just is still, amazingly enough, getting all kinds of traction all over the world. I'm really astonished, Steve.
You know, you got better accolades, more accolades on that album, for that album, than anything you had done before. Is that fair?
I'd say that's...
you hit it pretty good with that one.
Yeah, yeah. And I'm grateful for that. And
mm-hmm.
some of that we have something to do with, and some of it we don't, you know.
Well, what do you mean by that?
Well, I think everything that you release out into the world is subjective. People are going to like it or they won't. The time period that it's released, the era that it's released, who likes to play it, and what media gets a hold of it too. Because Sirius XM radio was not happening when that first record came out. Really, the first two records.
Yeah.
So
you're saying there's some serendipity when it comes to how an album is received, how a project is reviewed?
I think there is.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's always been the case. In the creative arts, you do the best work you can do and not only hope for the best, you do everything you can to get it out to people so they can actually hear it.
Mm-hmm.
But then it's out of your hands.
But still, when you heard what you heard about the Beautiful Bones, that must have felt pretty good.
It felt great, Steve, and I can't lie. You know, as somebody who's been doing this as long as I have, it felt really nice to hear that.
It was like you had been elevated somehow. You had been plucked. I mean, to some degree, mm-hmm. you had been knocked up a couple notches.
Right, and I honestly don't know why that is. I'm hoping it's because of the work,
mm-hmm.
you know, the music itself, and how I've developed over the years, as we all do in whatever our career is. You know, if you look back in your life 25 years, the work you were doing, I'm sure was good.
We try not to do that.
And you try.
We try not to go back to the first radio broadcast here. It was ugly, and people told me it was ugly, and you hope it's not so ugly anymore. Yeah.
Right. Well, yeah. I mean, I'm proud of the work I've done over the years, but
yeah.
I felt ready for the Beautiful Bones, and I feel ready for this next one.
Well, let's hear some more from the Beautiful Bones here. I should just point out that Kelly will be performing Saturday night at 8 at the Folly Theater downtown, a great venue to hear Kelly. Tickets are at follytheater.org, the concert presented by the Bridge Americana series and the Folly. Let's go and listen to some more from the Beautiful Bones. This is I Want You There. Got here.
fate or destiny. I do know that I love you, I love you.
That's Kelly Hunt, the track I Want You There from her album The Beautiful Bones that came out in 2014. Did you record that track we're listening to right now? Did you record that live?
Everything on that record, I played and sang at the same time and had the core band there. The singers, however, were me, and I did all the background.
That's you on all the background.
That's me
there.
And all the backgrounds.
And you put that on later then?
Yes. Well, yeah.
You go live because why?
You know what? Because I feel the energy.
Not everybody does that. Yeah.
No, not everybody does that, and there's a challenge to have all the musicians there at the same time. That's not always an option. But the guys that were brought in for this record are not only friends that live in Nashville, it was done in Nashville, but they're A-list players, and they were willing to come in and do that. We tracked for a couple weeks.
I cut you off. You were saying there's an energy there that is missing when you're not doing it live.
Well, there can be for me. And sometimes, you know, I'm so used to and love performing live that I feel a different energy. And so I play and sing at the same time.
Yeah.
And that brings different creative choices to the fore, and some of them are spontaneous. And when we made The Beautiful Bones, and I think like really any of the records prior, it's to me it's not about perfection. It's about the soul of the song. Where's the feel of that? You know, when I was a kid, my brother and sister had lots of records we'd spin. And we could hear the little crackle. We could hear the singer take a breath.
That was part of the thing.
Yeah, and even the quote mistakes on some of those records, like some of the James Brown things we listened to or Motown, those were just the coolest thing. Yeah. We waited for those.
Yeah.
And I'm
yeah.
not trying to do that. I'm trying to do the best I can. But we love to keep the takes that make you feel something.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know, it's interesting to me, Frank Sinatra, just reading about different artists over the years, oftentimes would bring his friends into the recording studio with him.
Yeah.
And you had a sense, and again, I'm not in that world, but he was doing that because that gave him a little extra pop when he was in front of the microphone. And I can sort of appreciate that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's the case. And when we did the live album, you know, we really only recorded two shows, one at the Grand Emporium and one at Liberty Hall Theater. And there was a different energy for that.
Yeah. Well, at this point in your career, do you get nervous before you go on stage?
I don't get nervous, but I get pumped up.
Pumped up. There's a difference, isn't there?
Yeah. There is. I don't feel, you know, sick to my stomach or feel like I don't want to do it. No, but I get very focused and energized.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, speaking of Bones, The Beautiful Bones, you've made no bones about the fact that Kansas City has in its influences have infused your music. I'm talking about folks like Jay McShann and Mary Lou Williams. When you were a kid, were you exposed to those folks?
Oh yes, my parents still listen to, you know, all that music. They had a long time in Kansas City when they were young, and then young marrieds, and so that's the kind of music that they still listen to at home. So, you know, when you're 4 or 5 years old and things are swinging, you know, there's boogie going on with Jay McShann's left hand.
Yes.
I was drawn to it like a moth to a flame.
No kidding. Yeah. Mary Lou Williams, so overlooked. I mean, so special and so underappreciated today. And you sort of wonder why.
I do wonder why, because she was a powerful artist. And what a technical pianist. Plus, when she played, you felt it. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if it was because she was a woman during that era that she was somewhat overlooked. But, you know, a lot of people around the world and even overseas know about her and value her work.
Yeah.
And, boy, it's hard not to.
Yeah. They had the famous cutting contest down to 18th and Vine.
Right.
Ben Webster and Lester Young and, you know, doing all this stuff. And it got to be 4 o'clock in the morning and the piano player fell asleep or was falling. They ran across the street and woke Mary Lou Williams up and said, come on over and play some more.
Yeah, and she did.
And she did.
That's the thing.
Wouldn't you have loved to have been somewhere like that? Yeah.
I wish.
Yeah. Did you ever hear folks like that live? Did you have a chance to hear Jay live?
A few times?
Yeah.
I saw Jay. We were on some similar festivals over the years where I could just sit and take in his set. Mm-hmm. And boy, was that a treat.
Yeah, right.
What a treat.
When did you start playing on your own?
On my own?
Yes.
Well, when I started performing out in the world, you mean?
Or, yeah, yeah.
I played in a band in high school, but when I went to college, I was playing in a group and also performing solo as well. And I still do both on a regular basis. So in my, you know, in my 20s, I was out hitting it, you know.
Right away. And you've been doing it ever since.
I have been doing it ever since I was 16.
What keeps you going?
I think it's just love of the music. And I think it's, I'm passionate about songwriting and having my hands on the keys.
Mm-hmm.
If I didn't do it for a living, I'd still do it every week anyway.
Huh.
Yeah.
And why the blues?
Well, I think the blues is a thread of style of music that runs through almost everything I do. It could be because of what I listened to growing up. Blues, roots, music, boogie, even a shade of gospel. And that resonated with me at a young age. New Orleans music, you know, part of the family lived in New Orleans. So I couldn't help myself, Steve. There it was, and it was there very early on.
Well, and the connection between Kansas City and New Orleans when it comes to the migration of the music has been well documented over so many decades here. Yeah.
True. And piano players especially.
Yeah.
It's like, come on now.
Yeah.
There's some serious piano playing going on.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. At some point, you were into Mahalia Jackson, Billie Holiday, Ray Charles, Aretha. Have you seen the new Aretha live documentary out?
We just went to it last week.
Did you?
And, you know, it was interesting to see. There isn't anybody on the planet like her, nor will there be. I can also see why she didn't want some of that released.
Because?
Because of the raw aspect to it. Things that had to be started over, some of the camera angles and shots. But I'm so grateful that her family allowed it because we get one more dose of, you know, the true Aretha. And that's some true stuff going on in that church.
We're talking about a new documentary about Aretha Franklin that's out. And critics have raved about it. And it's just something to behold, I guess, you know. Again, our phone number here, if you want to join our conversation, 816-235-2888. You can tweet us at KCUR up to date. Margaretha emailed us this and says, Kelly is one of the best, most soulful musicians I have ever experienced. Why has she not received worldwide acclaim and Grammys? I don't get it, is what she writes. And I don't know if you can answer a question like that.
Well, first of all, I can say thank you. My God, what a wonderful thing to hear.
Yes.
You know, and I think all I can do is the best work I can do and keep putting it out there and not quit. I'm nowhere near the finish line.
That's good to hear. Let's hear some more from the Beautiful Bones.
beautiful bald.
That is the title track from her 2014 album, The Beautiful Bones. That's Kelly Hunt. She performs again 8 o'clock Saturday evening at the Folly Theater downtown. Tickets at follytheater.org. You know, how much better is it for you, Kelly, to perform your own material as opposed to relying on outside writers? Because that's a world of difference in a whole lot of ways, isn't it?
Well, it is different. I think that as a creative person, you know, as a creative writer, it's nice for me to be able to do that and have it accepted and have people encourage that. Mm-hmm. Now, there are world-class writers everywhere, and I co-write with some of them.
Mm-hmm.
But it's gratifying to be able to do my own music since for the last 25 years.
Hey, how do you co-write these days? How does that work?
Well, I co-write both in person and, you know, via Skype.
Mm-hmm.
And both work for me.
Yeah.
And I have writers, Gary Nicholson in Nashville, that I write with. And when we're there, we get together in person. If we're not, we'll do it online. And
yeah. Let's go to Lisa from Prairie Village. Lisa, you're on Up to Date with Kelly Hunt. Good morning.
Hi, Kelly. Thank you. I'm a big fan, and I wanted to ask you just a little bit more about your boogie-woogie piano roots and also just share a story. My ex-in-laws lived in South Dakota and were huge fans of yours. My father-in-law was a boogie-woogie piano player, and my ex-mother-in-law used your song Love Never Dies at her funeral. So it was you've been a very meaningful part of a lot of our family, so thank you.
Oh, my gosh. Well, you know what? Thank you. I'm honored.
What about the boogie-woogie background?
The boogie background just had to do with the records my folks listened to, and I was drawn to it as a very young child. And I was lucky enough to have a piano teacher for 3 years that helped me learn that and work on it by ear, Mary Burke Norton. So, gosh, yeah, that means a lot to me to hear those questions.
Now, I want to ask you about another track from The Beautiful Bones, Release and Be Free. You co-produced this album with your husband, Al Berman, who's sitting with us here. And I was struck by a story that you told Tim Finn, the former Star music writer, about this track.
Right.
Al made you do it over again, even though you thought you had nailed it. And let's listen to a bit of Release and Be Free, because it's a stunning song, and then get your reaction to why Al had you redo it.
Okay.
I believe I am a carry this burden long enough. Yes, it is. To lay it down, 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 and rise up. Lay it down and rise up, that I may walk a lighter path, yeah, and see a clearer way.
You know, that is just a killer track.
Thank
you. It is just beautiful. And when your husband's sitting there saying, hey, just do it again, that's not a song you can just sort of stand up and do all over again, is it? And that takes a little bit of focus, I imagine.
It does. And he was so right to do that, though. And we trust each other's approach in the studio. He's great at what he does, and I feel really good at what I do. So,
what was wrong with the first take, or the earlier take?
Well, the first take was technically okay. I didn't realize I was doing it at the time, but I was trying to make it sound too perfect, and I was being too guarded about what notes I was going to go for. And it sounded good, you know. I thought it was okay, and he understood that I hadn't even got close. And so that what you hear is a combination of me letting go and me trusting him and me going there. It's a vulnerable place to be, to put something out there like this.
Yeah.
And I thought, he's right. And we didn't even talk about it. I said, go, let's go again. And I did it right then. This is the take that happened within about 15 seconds of him saying, you know, Kel, we're not there yet. And I know there's more in there that you're not allowing out. And boy, he was right. First, I went, man, what?
Yeah.
You know?
First, that's hard to hear at first when you just finish it up and you think you've done it
yeah.
just right.
If you were to, and you never will, if you were to hear the take before this.
I was just going to say, I would pay money to hear you compare the two. That would be interesting.
Yeah, the one before this is actually good, but it's not great.
That's interesting. Well, this is a great track. I just love this song.
Ah, thank you.
That's a great Kelly Hunt. She'll be performing again 8 o'clock Saturday night at the Folly Theater downtown. Tickets, follytheater.org. Kelly, it's always great to have you here. Good luck on Saturday. We'll all be rooting for you.
Thank you, Steve. Thanks for having me.
You bet. Yesterday in the show, we looked at two of the nation's most monumental U.S. Supreme Court cases and asked listeners how their lives were impacted by them. You can hear that and other previous episodes at kcur.org/uptodate. You can find and follow us on Twitter. We're at kcuruptodate. Follow me at Steve Kraske. Tomorrow, Gloria Squatiro was only the First Lady of Kansas City, barred from City Hall. We'll ask her about that and about her time as Mayor Funkhauser's right hand. She's writing about all that and more in a new series of books. Gloria Squatiro, the former Kansas City First Lady, on the show tomorrow. Our show is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Devin Davis, and Elizabeth Ruiz. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.